KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining today on Hearsay Culture. We're recording the show on Wednesday, November 25th, and I'm very excited to have on the show today Professor James Grimmelman, a return guest on Hearsay Culture. James is an associate professor at New York Law School and a member of its Institute for Information, Law, and Policy. And James, over the last really at least year, has become the go-to person on the myriad issues involving the Google book search settlement and Google book search process. And that is going to be the focus of our discussion today. For those that are not familiar, and James will explain in more detail, Google, among many other of its efforts, in about 3 or 4 years ago, I think, decided that one of its endeavors could be to literally digitize printed works, digitize libraries, and allow those works to be searchable the same way that the internet generally is searchable. And this raises a lot of different issues. It raises issues of copyright. It raises issues of privacy. It raises issues of surveillance. There are antitrust issues involved. And we are going to explore many of those issues today. The genesis, of course, of the dispute came when the Authors Guild actually sued Google on a variety of claims, challenging Google's ability to affect the Google book search. And that process, the litigation, that is, has led to a variety of motions, but more significantly, and the focus of our discussion today will be efforts to settle the dispute. A settlement came out, and then a revised settlement came out a couple of weeks ago at this point, within the last couple of weeks, and the revised settlement attempts to address many of the issues that have been raised not only by the parties, but also by third parties that have put their two cents into the discussion as it's been in front of Judge Chin in the Southern District of New York. The issues here are many. The significance, of course, is huge. One commentator actually referred to, in fact, I say commentator, I should say, representative of Google, referred to their efforts as building the Library of Alexandria, and our guest James Grimmelman actually pointed out that it's even bigger than that. I'm very excited to have James on. His work that I have regarded very highly for a long time, and he's taken on the mantle of being not only the go-to person for Google book search, but also literal documented on a day-to-day and even hour-to-hour basis, it seems, all the different machinations and movements in the process. James received his JD from Yale Law School. He was editor-in-chief of LawMem and a member of the Yale Law Journal. He has an AB in computer science, which is quite helpful in our field, from Harvard, and worked as a programmer at Microsoft. He's also been a resident fellow for the Information Society Project at Yale. I will be having Laura DeNardis on next year, who is the current director. He was also a legal intern for Creative Commons and the Electronic Frontier Foundation, as well as a law clerk to Marianne Trump Barry of the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. He is a prolific writer and author. He's had several law review articles come out recently, including a piece on ethical visions of copyright law and others. But our focus today, and his focus, I think, over the last year, it seems, has been largely to document Google book search and its issues. James, thank you for taking the time the day before Thanksgiving to chat with us on Hearsay Culture.
Well, thank you for having me back, Dave. It's great to be back on.
I appreciate it. James, let's start off. I talked a bit about your background, but perhaps I'll ask you this question. What interested you about Google book search? Why have you deemed this to be something of such importance to take as much time as you have documenting the issues? What's the genesis of your interest?
So I came to Google book search through the search end of that. I've written about Google and other search engines in the past because they're a really interesting intersection point for a lot of legal issues today. Copyright, free speech, privacy, lots of things come together around search. And so when Google started scanning books and got sued for it a few years ago, I kind of paid attention to the lawsuit because it affected search in one of its forms, but I wasn't paying really close attention to it. Then in October of last year, when instead of going off and having a lawsuit and a trial on whether or not Google was infringing copyright by scanning all these books, Google and the Authors Guild and the publishers came back and they presented this settlement. And I started, you know, digging into it and blogging a little bit about it just to satisfy my curiosity. And it was one of these things in which the settlement was so complicated that I think most people were just sort of assuming that somebody else would look into it and say what it said. And I made the mistake of actually doing that.
So it's the curse of the competent of sorts.
Yeah, I didn't really have that much of an edge in interest or knowledge of it to start out with. But when you know, you know, even a little bit from having actually just read the damn thing once, it gave me, like, wow, there's a lot of stuff in here that's really interesting. That's actually pretty important that I should try to explain to people about why it matters. And from that, I've been basically drawn into writing about the settlement, but also, as you mentioned, running a project to basically provide public information on it. We have a website called the Public Index, and we just keep track of all of the filings in the case, a lot of the commentary on it, trying to make it a kind of centralized clearinghouse for people who want to learn about this incredibly important case.
And you've also, it seems like Google Book Search has largely, although not exclusively, co-opted your own blog that you've been running for a while at laboratorium.net.
Yeah, it got to the point that I realized I had to actually separate out the Google-related posts from everything else. So I actually tagged them as GBS now. So the people who are tired of hearing me rant about the Book Search settlement can just scroll on to whatever else I have posted, although there's increasingly little of anything besides Google Book Search stuff there.
Now, let's for listeners that aren't familiar, I think before we get into some of the, I think, fascinating issues related with the revised settlement that came out, I think to set the stage for people that aren't familiar with this at all, and I've been, even though I focus in this area, and so I would have more awareness, I've been surprised at how many people are not familiar with the issue, hence my invitation to have you on the show. So I gave a very brief 20-second statement of what Google Book Search is, but I'll ask you several questions in order to delve into this. But perhaps you could describe in your own words what the goal or goals of the project is and its contours in terms of how many books or what books are we talking about? Is it every book published or what are its limitations? So we can start there. What are its goals and what are its aspirations?
So, of course, Google's mission is to make the world's information searchable. And on the web, they can just do that by having their computers ask web servers, show us your pages, and we'll add them to our index. Now, with books, most books don't come with an interface where you can ask them a question like, does the word legal appear in your pages anywhere? Pre-digital technology. So Google decided that the same way that they got an index web pages for search, that it would be really helpful to their users if they could index books. So that way you'd go to Google and you'd type in a search term, and it would tell you which books had used those words and on what pages, which would be an immense help for research, because you now know, okay, not just author and title and a few keywords, but you actually can find quotations you're trying to track down. You can find books that deal with very specific subjects, even for just a few pages.
Mm-hmm.
It makes books much more accessible. The thing being, in order to actually index the book to say which words appear in it where, you pretty much have to scan it. They have these specialized machines that take high-resolution photos of facing pairs of pages, and then they run it through character recognition technology to figure out what the words on the pages are. And then using that, they can build the index. So on the way to having their index of what the books say, they're making complete copies of them.
And therein, of course, is the rub from a copyright law perspective, for starters.
Yeah. So authors feel, on the one hand, that Google's making complete copies of books. That's something that copyright should control. They need to pay me or get my permission for it. And authors and publishers also feel, well, Google's going to make some money providing this indexing service. That money is somehow ours. We're entitled to a cut of it. Now, both of these propositions are, I think, pretty debatable from a copyright point of view. what I would have said is that what Google is doing is a fair use, because they're not scanning the books to sell copies of the books and compete with the publishers and authors. They're scanning the books to make a transformative use, that is, making books searchable. And courts have held that making copies of web pages or showing excerpts of them can be a fair use on the web, because it's for a transformative purpose of helping people find web pages. And I would think the same principle ought to apply to books, but it's an open question in the law, and thus that was what the original lawsuit was about. The authors and publishers saying this is a copyright infringement, Google saying no, it's a fair use, and that would have been a, you know, the fair use trial of the century, I think.
Now, and I do want to get into the copyright issues, and particularly transformation, because, of course, we're still dealing with the fact that these are duplicates, and so we could debate the transformative nature not of this work, notwithstanding the fact that there are cases, as you indicated, that say that putting this work in a new context that's searchable and ultimately good to the public, good for the public, it can be a fair use. But I do want to get the backstory down to set the framework. So based upon what you said, and to be clear, Google embarked upon this project without seeking the permission of the authors. Is that correct, or am I missing a factor?
Yeah, that's right. They just announced in 2004 and 2005, we've got these library partners, starting with the University of Michigan, and it expanded out to include Stanford and Texas and a bunch of other major libraries, saying, basically, we have agreements to take all the books on their shelves and scan them. And they announced this, I think, expecting to be showered with praise from all quarters, and the copyright owners reacted with horror as soon as they realized that Google was scanning books that were in copyright. Google pretty quickly retreated to the position where they would say, if you ask us to, we will exempt your book from the scanning. If you ask us to, we will not display any results from it that actually include text of your book. So you can opt out, but unless we hear from you, we will go ahead and do it.
Now, the opt-out portion of this, and again, this is all to set the framework of where we are today, is an interesting one. And we see right now there's this hot issue involving Fox News saying that or threatening that they will delist themselves or ask to be delisted from Google. And now there's reports that they may be trying to set up an exclusive deal with Microsoft and the Bing engine that's come out recently. But this opt-out idea, I think, again, raises an interesting background question, which is, in the process of putting this proposal to the public and saying we're just going to do it, the onus, at least initially, was put on the authors themselves to opt out as opposed to opting in. And what is the significance of that distinction, if any, between asking the authors to opt out versus the opt-in idea, which is almost the equivalent of getting permission?
So, I mean, I think the differences are pretty stark in that if you have an opt-in system, you will not have good search engines. If you look at on the web today, most sites don't have the robots.txt file, which is the one that controls what search engines can see. So if you ask people to opt in, you'd find that most things weren't searchable. It's especially true for books, where people weren't thinking about the possibility of search, and you're unlikely to get that many partners for a program anytime quickly. Opt-in also makes it very hard for new people to compete in the market once you have a dominant player, because the second place person basically has to go to everyone and convince them to opt into its service, too, which is an enormous barrier to entry once somebody has achieved a pretty substantial number of books. So opt-in is really dangerous for ever having good comprehensive indices. On the other hand, authors and publishers have this sense, which has, I think, been quite traceable to changes in copyright law, that copyright is always supposed to be an opt-in system. That is, if you don't get permission from the copyright owner, you are infringing. And that's the general position of, for example, the Berne Convention, the International Copyright Treaty that says, in essence, you need to get permission, and people's exercise of their copyrights cannot be contingent on any formality. So you can't make people pay a fee to acquire a copyright. The copyright should exist from the moment they put pen to paper.
We're talking
with... the authors and publishers...
I'm sorry, go ahead, James.
For the authors and publishers, this is an issue of deep principle.
We're talking with Professor James Grumman of New York Law School on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Now, you mentioned earlier, you made reference to potential revenue streams here. And, of course, Google is a for-profit entity, and so money has to be made somewhere. So where does Google envision its revenue coming from as a result of taking on this project?
So the original project to make books searchable was going to be, like most of their others, an ad-funded service. The idea being, actually, that you see ads when you search for books, and Google makes a few cents from the ads if you click through on them, and that money funds the operation of the whole thing.
So the ads themselves are the revenue stream, and to me, unless I'm missing a nuance, this sounds like the same types of streams that exist in search generally, no?
Yeah, it's exactly the same.
Okay. So with that background, I think we can start talking about some of the detailed issues here. And I think I want to start that discussion with thinking about this, not from the perspective of the authors, but perhaps from the perspective of users. So as a user of the internet, as a consumer of the content on the internet, and most of us, anyone with access to a computer, are, the search engines being the window to the internet, the way that the internet is organized and how we can make sense of all of the data out there. As a user, is there any reason for me to be concerned about, and we're going to get to privacy and surveillance and those issues in a moment, but just to be concerned about what is being indexed or the accuracy of it. Are we looking at a system that, as a researcher, I will have confidence in knowing that I have gotten accurate information and even more specifically, that the research I'm doing is comprehensive?
So these are always questions about media literacy. And I think the answer is really just to always be aware of how the things you are seeing were generated, where they came from, and what process was used to create them. So if you do a search on a search engine, you have pretty much no guarantee of comprehensiveness. You know, take doing a search in Google Books. The book a book might have been removed by its copyright owner. It might not have been in the collection of a library that Google was scanning from. It might have been scanned with some incorrect bibliographic information because the library's own records or any other sources Google relied on were inaccurate. So you always have a few things that drop off and aren't present. And it's especially true in the current day and age when they're in the process and they may have scanned volumes 1, 3, and 4 of a multi-volume book but not volume 2. So you're always going to have comprehensiveness misses. And that's something you have to sort of be aware of, the limitation of this kind of search. Now, in terms of accuracy, a product like this that actually will show you the pages from the book from which they were taken is really good, because that's actually connecting you with a, if not necessarily primary source, a more primary source. You can check the text and make sure that what the book actually says, and you can see it in context with some bibliographic information. And as long as you understand, okay, this is this physical book, which was printed in whatever year and found its way into this library's collection, and that's what I'm citing and seeing, that's actually really good. That's about as good as you get when you go to your own library and check out books.
So can Google do, or another way, can Google meet its goals, as you've articulated them, with something short of what the authors would consider to be a copyright violation?
I don't think so. I just don't see a way to do a full index in a way that the authors would not consider to be, in some sense, freeloading off of their work. They see money that is being earned that is somehow, some way connected to their books, and jump to the conclusion that they are entitled to some cut of that.
Now, the issues of accuracy as well as comprehensiveness, I think, raise another interesting question with respect to how users analyze or how users would actually interact with Google Book Search. And that's the issue of transparency within Google's own operations. As you know, Frank Pasquale at Seton Hall and others have written that Google has a some form of a public duty, really, to be more open and allow more sunshine into their actual search process, the algorithms and how they go about ranking and so forth. And that issue has constantly percolated, and Google has not generally been willing to reveal that information, alleging that it's a trade secret, which it very well may be, and that it's commercial and proprietary information that they cannot give away without damaging their own ability to turn a profit on their process. Is Google Book Search any different? I mean, is there any reason for Google to take a different position with respect to transparency on this issue, especially given the fact that there is a very high-profile lawsuit going on with commentators coming not only from the U.S. but internationally weighing in on what should be done?
I don't see the transparency issues here as deeply different, certainly when it comes to the algorithms. There's one reason that Google could be more transparent here than it is elsewhere. On the web search, one of the big reasons Google gives to use trade secret protection and to not reveal the details of how its algorithms work is they have to deal with search engine optimizers, essentially people who create spam web pages in order to trick the search engine into delivering you to their ad-filled pages. And one of the reasons that this is problematic is that if Google tells you how it ranks pages, people will study through the listings and they'll reverse engineer the perfect page to hit the top of Google's rankings. That works on the web because they can turn around web pages really quickly. With books that are published in print form, that's not so much of a worry. So you don't have the same kind of transparency fears there. I think Google has fewer countervailing reasons to need to be as secretive about its search algorithms for books as it would on the web.
Is it your personal view, or do you have a position on the broader question, as I mentioned, as you articulated, about whether Google should in fact reveal or be more transparent about search generally?
My general position on search and transparency is that I fear the search engine optimizers and the spammers and the malware distributors a lot more than I fear a slightly opaque search engine. I agree with Frank that there are real concerns about transparency in a lot of intermediaries, but I regard the need for increased disclosure as a case that still remains to be made rather than a set of known abuses that need to be stopped now.
And to be clear for listeners that aren't familiar, when you're referring to search engine optimizers, you're referring to literally entities that claim that they can game the search process to allow for a client's name or what have you to be ranked higher in the process, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Basically, if you pay us some amount of money, we will come in and edit your web pages, and we will move you up onto the first page of Google results.
So Frank's comments also reveal, I think, another issue that gets us into the lawsuit in more detail, which is his argument that regulation is necessary. And I'll ask that same question with respect to book search. Is there any reason at this point for regulation to exist to deal with the issues of Google Book Search beyond the regulations that already exist that would impact the operations of search engines and so forth?
No, if we're talking about search engines, book search strikes me as a market that can pretty safely stay in a largely deregulated state. Google is proving, basically, how much it costs to scan a whole bunch of books and index them, and Yeah, it's a significant chunk of change, but it's not prohibitive. The costs are going to fall over time. This is an area that a lot of other people were jumping into. So, for example, the Internet Archive has been making a big push to scan lots of interesting public domain materials. And this strikes me as an area in which people will compete on their collections and the quality of their search. And there's not a particularly strong reason to come in and regulate that part of the market.
We're talking with Professor James Grohman, author and the major, documenter of the Google Book Search settlement process on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. James, before we take a break, I think to get us into the issues related to the settlement, perhaps you could give us just the brief overview of the litigation and in terms of when it began and then where we are right now.
Sure. So in late 2005, shortly after Google revealed that it was scanning in copyright books as part of its program, the Authors Guild and Association of American Publishers filed lawsuits against Google, demanding that it stop. And the Authors Guild lawsuit was a class action, which meant that it was brought on behalf of all copyright owners of, at the time, books in the University of Michigan library where Google was starting its scanning. And you know, they were going to have the big trial on the fair use issues we were talking about. And the judge tells them, okay, you need to go and discuss settlement. And it's a routine step. And actually, they realized they could hit a deal. So they spent the next 2 years negotiating out a settlement. And that settlement was unveiled to the world last October. And it's pretty remarkable because it goes well beyond the fair use questions that were thought to be at stake by everyone else. So on the one hand, it lets Google go on scanning books and provides Google will pay copyright owners $60 for each book that it has already scanned. And on the other, it provides for a remarkable set of new programs by which Google will actually sell you digital copies of all these books. And so it creates these big revenue-sharing programs under which Google will now start selling digital copies of the books it scanned, and it will pass 63% of the money back to the copyright owners.
Thrilling Amazon and Barnes & Noble and other competitors in the booksell market.
Yeah, you see, Google coming into your space is not a good sign for your
right,
business.
Right. Yeah, the last competitor you want is the entity that that starts its lower ambition projects in mapping the entire globe and then takes on books. We're talking with Professor James Grohman on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to KZSU regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. You can go to KZSU's webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Or alternatively, you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Either way, I do hope you consider making a donation and that you continue to listen to KZSU and its diverse programming. James, the wheel was spun when the litigation was filed, and it landed with Judge Chin, who, having practiced in New York, certainly has an excellent reputation, and also is a judge that is known for having a particular proficiency in intellectual property disputes. Overall, what's your impression of Judge Chin and how he's handled the litigation thus far?
Well, I should say that it actually only landed in Judge Chin's lap this past year.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
He was initially assigned to Judge Spizzo,
okay,
who actually passed away
right
shortly after he gave the preliminary approval to the first settlement.
Ah, okay.
So Judge Chin has had to get up to speed on this incredibly complicated case and settlement pretty quickly.
So it wasn't quite a luck of the draw on the wheel then. So that would explain certainly his presence there. And have you found, based on what you said, I think he's done a more than adequate and admirable job handling this dispute.
It's interesting. There's a whole sideline that I get into and a lot of people who comment on my blog get into, of basically, it's like Kremlinology. You're trying to read what Judge Chin is thinking about the settlement
right.
based upon his very short one-sentence orders on the various motions. He seems to be running a fairly tight ship in that he wants a minimum of procedural distractions. He wants things done all out in the open and relatively cleanly, and he wants the whole process on track to be on his desk for a decision at some point.
Mm-hmm.
So that could indicate that he's either read through everything and thinks that he knows how he wants to rule, so he just wants to get this wrapped up. It could be that he is willing to let the parties do this as they say and give it their best shot, at the end of which he's prepared to rule. It could be that he is not paying close attention to the filings yet, and he's just trying to keep everything in good order until they're all in and he can read the filings closely. All of these are possible. I think people are getting the sense that he's generally inclined towards approving the settlement, just in part because of the language he uses in denying people's attempts to derail it. But we aren't really going to know that until the fairness hearing in February, or even until his actual ruling, who knows how long after that.
Now, again, for the listeners who aren't familiar, what is the fairness hearing?
So, because the Authors Guild filed as a class action, the settlement is also a class action. The settlement would opt in all the copyright owners in the United States and several other countries into Google's new book sales program. And, you know, as a routine procedural caution in the U.S. system, before you can have a settlement of a class action lawsuit, the court has to give members of the class a chance to object and to file their concerns about the settlement, and then it has to conduct a hearing to decide whether or not the settlement is actually, the term is, fair, reasonable, and adequate to the class members. So that's scheduled for February.
James, before we get into some of the details of the settlement, I think since you brought up Kremlinology, it occurs to me I should ask you. So, in the world of Kremlinology, would you liken yourself more to James Angleton or to Dulles in terms of your role in this process?
Oh man, you're going too deep in terms of my spy knowledge.
Are you the person attempting to root out the agent that is undermining your intelligence, or are you more along the lines of a Dulles who is building the network and as the puppet master moving the pieces on the board?
Maybe I'm more like a James Bamford, you know, trying to write books from the outside about how this system works.
Fair enough. Yes, I reveal one of a side interest of mine, which is the intelligence community and that world. So I can get a little esoteric in that regard. One of the major concerns, and we turn now to the settlement and where it stands right now. One of the major concerns that has been raised, and it's been raised, I think, most prominently by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Concerns government surveillance. And EFF has spent several years suing AT&T, as they pointed out, because AT&T decided that it would not stand up to the private to the government with respect to privacy concerns when the government asked for its records regarding communications made by its customers. Is, in your view, EFF's concern well-founded? And if so, what's your analysis of this government surveillance question with respect to Google Book Search? How does it play out, and is it a well-founded concern?
So, I mean, the privacy issues with regard to a product like Google Book Search, especially once it actually has full books involved, are pretty striking. It's easy to think about things that you would not want visible in your reading habits to others. So you've got, you know, How to Quit Your Drug Addiction in 6 Easy Steps. This is not a book that you would really like others to be able to find out that you've been reading closely. And when it comes to the government, you can imagine uses that would be, you know, pretty worrisome from a privacy perspective. So what if the government comes to Google and it asks for a list of everyone who has read more than 5 pages of any edition of the Quran. So that's where EFF is starting from with their concerns about privacy and government surveillance, which is that your reading habits, which is one of the classic components of intellectual freedom, are under, you know, real threat. I mean, keep in mind that, you know, the central piece of rebellion in 1984 is keeping a private diary and then getting a private copy of a forbidden book.
Right.
There are obvious huge privacy issues, obvious concerns with the government, and the EFF-Google dispute here is really over how hard Google will resist governmental attempts to ask for information. Google has a decent record on this compared with other internet companies. They actually litigated and won a case asking for them to disclose some search records a few years back. The EFF would like essentially a commitment to do that from Google, and Google's not willing to provide that.
And why not? I mean, why are they unwilling to take that that step, in your view?
I can think of two reasons. One is that as a company, they always want the flexibility. They would prefer to be able to cooperate when they see it as being in their interest, and to make those calls themselves. And companies almost always want to reserve that kind of discretion for themselves. And the other is, I think, tactical. That Google knows that sometimes they may have to be defending people who are pretty unsympathetic or have bad facts on their side. And if they're going to make a principled stand, they would rather, like the EFF in a sense, be able prefer to pick their litigation and really fight it when they think they're much likely to win and set a good precedent.
One of the things you've written that, recently that I find particularly interesting, I want to explore a little bit, is about Google's ethic of do no evil. And you've connected that idea by pointing out recently that it sounds particularly Christian, and you wrote, and this is a quote, "When faced with a moral dilemma, the Googlers withdraw to their cave for prayer and fasting to consult their inner lights, then emerge with the confidence of one through whom God has spoken." This is, you know, quite alliterative language, but I think it's something to explore a little bit. Should, assuming that the idea of do no evil is something that comforts us, regardless of whether you are a member of the Christian faith or not, should we take comfort, we as the public, take comfort in Google's aspirational goals and their overall credo? What is its significance in the context of the concerns raised with respect to Google Book Search generally?
So Google, I think there's no doubt, has been a company that really takes its ethical mission seriously in terms of it being something that its employees think about and that guides most of their decision-making. I mean, in part, it's been a strategy that has been very successful for them. It's right along with their very clean, minimalist design ethos, their emphasis on relentless performance tuning, and their insistence on having good conversations about what's the ethical thing for them to do as a company. And you know, whenever you see how they make decisions, they really include things that are public serving in a lot of their products. So Google Book Search includes this, you know, the proposed settlement includes a provision under which they will be allowed to offer free service, free complete access to their catalog to public libraries. You know, it's limited, one terminal per library, but it's still, there are people in there who are thinking about the public interest very seriously, and there's no doubt that they see it as being part of their mission. At the same time, it's really crossed with, I don't know, kind of institutional arrogance. There is this, it's not do no evil, it's don't be evil. And Anil Dash, the blogger, pointed out very pertinently that this is, that Google assumption is you're either evil or you're not, and we're not evil. And so, in part because they take their ethics seriously, they have a sense that once they've reached a decision, they have trouble understanding why others don't recognize it as being the right decision and give them the proper credit for it. So they make ethical striving all the time, but they also have a kind of righteousness about the answer once they think they've got it. And they can be sometimes a little tone-deaf to others' concerns. And, of course, when it comes to whether we should trust them or not, you know, the old slogan is, of course, past performance is no guarantee of future results. That people who are at Google right now are, I think, pretty committed to creating great software and great services that do good things for the world. But when you're thinking about a program like Google Book Search that's, you know, the whole world's knowledge captured in one place, you ask, well, you know, in the long term, how long will they stay this way? When this generation takes their options on vests out and retires to a life of ease, will the people who came after them share those commitments? How long will this corporate culture stay? And that's one reason to think about building protections into the settlement now, so that Google doesn't have the ability to backslide in the future.
We're talking with Professor James Grimmelman on the Google Book Search issues and the settlement therein on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. James, we have about 12 minutes left, and I do want to ask you, related to this ethic, is there a reason or are you concerned about a private for-profit entity creating the world's library? Notwithstanding that ethics, are there reasons to be concerned, or is it not something about which you are particularly concerned?
Google's status as private for-profit or governmental or nonprofit doesn't really concern me that much. I worry about concentration of power in any one set of hands, and I worry about accountability. But, I mean, one of the sort of sad things that I've learned from working with law for is that pretty much any kind of institution can become ossified, corrupt, unaccountable, and that it's really about how you create good structures of ongoing accountability, quality review, and, you know, review for basic fairness, and that you really have to be attentive to designing the institutions right from the start, regardless of whether it's for-profit, non-profit, governmental, or what.
One of the interesting issues related to copyright here, but also to the general issue of accessibility of information, is the issue of orphan works. That is works that are copyright protected, but where the author or copyright owner cannot be found. How is the orphan works issue an issue in Google Book Search, and how does the settlement address it?
So, of course, you've got plenty of books you can't find the author or publisher anymore. This may happen often because of corporate mergers or because the publisher goes bankrupt. Eventually somebody buys up the asset and doesn't realize they own copyrights. Same thing can happen with an author. You know, the author dies and their heirs may not realize the full extent of the copyrights they own because of it. And so you have people out there who own these things and don't realize it, which means that if you want to print a new edition of the book, you don't know who to ask, you can't find them, and now you can't take the risk of just running off copies because you'd be sued if they ever did show up. So those books are, they're called orphaned, they just sit around and no uses are made of them, and they're effectively lost to the public. So Google, by going to the libraries and just scanning books, and then getting legal permission through the lawsuit to start selling them again, brings the orphans back into circulation. Mm-hmm. That's actually a very exciting piece of the settlement. It would provide for the minute availability of a lot of orphan works. That's also one of the reasons the settlement is worrisome. It's really worrisome in two ways because of this. On the one hand, you have a class action fear. There's a lawsuit on behalf of the large and unknown, you know, multi-million member class of authors and publishers. And we all but know that many members of it, hundreds of thousands, possibly even millions or more, will never show up. That is, they don't realize they own copyrights. They're not going to show up to take control of their works. They're not going to show up potentially to opt out. And they won't even show up to be paid with their share of the 63%. So there are questions about whether it's fair to take this class that includes people who we know can't actually protect themselves and bind them to this big commercial deal. On the other hand, there's also a fear that maybe we're not asking them for enough, that They're getting into this deal that benefits Google, you know, one particular company with its particular collection, its particular resources, and it becomes the only source for these books. So the copyright now prevents anybody else from competing with Google. If Yahoo tries to go out and scan books and sell them, of course that's infringing. So it would actually be illegal for anyone to make a truly competing product. And in that context, you worry about the antitrust problems mm-hmm. of the settlement that gives Google effectively exclusive access to all of his orphan works.
Would you expect that the antitrust issue would be fatal to the settlement? And I say that only because we haven't seen antitrust being enforced that heavily recently. Now, the Justice Department under President Obama may change course, but how significant do you see the antitrust issue from a practical perspective of the settlement being enforceable?
In part, it's interesting because the antitrust issue here can be raised by private litigants. So some of Google's competitors, you know, for obviously self-interested reasons, have been informing the court about what they see as the serious antitrust problems that it raises. To me, I'm still thinking through it, because you can make an argument that access to the books is still better than no access, but you could also make a strong argument that copyright was not meant to reward the intermediary, in this case, like Google, that if we're going to have a monopoly in anyone's hands, it's supposed to be the authors. And to me, this is one of the two deeply troubling issues about the settlement, the other being this use of the class action.
And that issue, in the remaining 6 minutes or so that we have, aside from asking you what other projects you're working on, I think is a very interesting one that I haven't seen a lot written about, but that you I think have identified. So again, we've talked a little bit about what class actions are, but given that, what is the concern about the class action structure in the context of the settlement?
So partly they're just the garden variety class action issues. You know, you're supposed to give members of the class sufficient notice of the class action. And you know, they spent millions of dollars mailing out letters and publishing notices in newspapers. And still there were concerns that most people didn't realize this was going on. You talked about how you were stunned at how few people knew about this lawsuit. Imagine how many of your listeners are authors who own copyrights.
Right.
And you ask, did they realize this lawsuit was affecting potentially how their books will appear? They're working on some of those things, but those are kind of accidental, or they're not inherent in the settlement itself issues. If you spent enough on better notice, maybe that would be solved. The really deep, really troublesome issue to me is that the settlement involves future claims. Your ordinary class action lawsuit is typically compensation for past harms. Somebody made a rusty toy truck, the metal piece, you know, stabbed a bunch of kids in the hand, they get, you know, go to the hospital and get bandaged up. That's a defective product, the parents all sue, and they get, you know, damages from the company for making a defective product, and that's it. It's a past harm, you get paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this settlement involves Google getting immunity to go on and sell books. That is, it's being authorized to do things in the future, things it hasn't done yet. And that's a line that our class action system doesn't cross often, perhaps even at all.
Is the court capable of mitigating those concerns?
This element includes a lot of terms designed to constrain what Google will do, to ensure future monitoring, to allow people to exercise some control over what will happen in the future. But in some ways, it's very risky to play around with future claims and class actions because they're in the future. We don't know what the scope of the harms might be. We don't know everything that might happen. It's hard for authors right now to assess the pros and cons of staying in the settlement, and it's hard for the court to assess whether it's fair to them. We get into an area where the courts are just not very good at assessing the pros and cons.
We're talking with James Grimmelman, professor at New York Law School and documenter and analyzer of the Google Book Search process on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So, James, you know, KZSU Stanford University is just a few miles north of the headquarters of Google in Mountain View, California. And I always ask the unfair, or oftentimes ask the unfair crystal ball question. And so I'll ask you that one as well. Based upon your analysis, will the settlement be successful? Will there be eventually a settlement that the court will approve and will allow for Google Book Search to go forward?
I don't know. I've speculated that Judge Tin might approve it. Perhaps the Second Circuit will then reject it on appeal, but I really don't know. We're breaking new legal ground here.
Is and the appeals process is something I think which again, unless you're a lawyer, may not be self-evident. But are we looking, again, total crystal ball, recognizing we don't have any certainty to it, but are we looking at issues you think that are certain to go up on appeal? And if so, are there any issues that you think should go up on appeal that require higher courts to really rule on so that we have precedent that we can use on a going forward basis?
I have seen few cases that I could be more confident would be appealed no matter what happens. I think this one is going for the Second Circuit eventually, and it has a decent shot of hitting the Supreme Court.
Now, that was going to be my next question. And again, these are the crazy tea leaf questions that if a client asks you these questions, you say, I can't answer. But I'll ask you anyway, and you feel free to decline it. If you were to predict the issue or issues that would be the reason that the Supreme Court would grant certiorari, what would they be?
It would be the class action and the antitrust issues. And I have to say that I'm actually quite heartened that Justice Sotomayor is on the court now because of her, you know, really good record in thinking through some hard intellectual property issues.
So Google Book Search is something that certainly we can't look for in the near term, and I would say certainly in the next year from if I read your analysis correctly. But it's something that certainly we can hope for as being eventually coming to fruition, covering many if not all of the concerns raised by the authors. Would that be a fair synopsis?
I honestly don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, I've
different directions.
No, as a litigator, I'm pushing a lawyer to answer questions that, like I said, as a litigator, I probably would have a difficult time answering if I could answer them at all. So a fair enough answer. James, before I let you go and enjoy the Thanksgiving holiday, I do want to ask you, you have a number of projects that you work on other than Google Book Search. So perhaps for listeners, what are a few of those projects and where can, just for repetition sake, where can listeners find out more about your work?
So first, on the Google Book Search side, the site again that we have devoted to it is The Public Index. That's thepublicindex.org, which has links to all the filings and commentary in the case. And then you can get more about my own writings from my homepage at james.grimmelman.net, where you'll find things like Saving Facebook, an article about privacy on social networks.
James Grimmelman, professor of law at New York Law School. Thank you so much, James, for joining us at Hearsay Culture and educating listeners on this critical issue. I certainly imagine that I will have you back on the show, if you will agree, to discuss where we are and to discuss other work that you're involved with. As always, I anticipate your work and look forward to reading it. And thank you again for joining us, and enjoy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. And I think it's always a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, James. I'm very excited to mention for the remaining few shows of the quarter that we will be talking with Professor Wendy Chun of Brown University, as well as hopefully on the schedule, if it fits in, for this year, if not for next, Kazis Varnalis from Columbia University. Most importantly, we have a large group of outstanding guests that are going to be coming on the show, not only this quarter, but in the quarter that begins in January of next year. And among them are Professor C.V. Vaidyanathan from the University of Virginia, as I mentioned, Kazis Varnalis from Columbia University, Also, Professors Frank Pasquale, who we discussed today, as well as Daniel Citron from Seton Hall and University of Maryland Law Schools, respectively, discussing fusion centers. Professor Bobby Quall from DePaul University. Professor Tarleton Gillespie will be on the show in January discussing his work in copyright. The aforementioned Laura DeNardis from Yale University's Information Society Project, Subha Ghosh from the University of Wisconsin, as well as Chris Kelty and Manuel Castells discussing their recent books in communications, Chris Kelty's book Two Bits, and Professor Castells' book Communication Power. Pardon me, and listeners may have picked up that I am fighting a little bit of a cold. I tried to cover as much as possible. I almost made it. For those people that want to hear the show other than on KZSU, where you can hear it live, and the first airing of it is found there, you can also get the show by going to the Center for Internet Society's iTunes page and subscribing there, where you can not only get Hearsay Culture, but all of the events occurring at the Center for Internet Society. You can also get the show by going to Hearsay Culture's webpage at hearsayculture.com, where you can get all previous shows as well as check out the upcoming schedule. You can lastly get the show by going to our RSS feed at Stanford Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. As always, I welcome your comments, feedback, suggestions at dave@hearsayculture.com. So I thank you for listening today. Enjoy Thanksgiving, and please stay tuned to more diverse programming on KZSU FM Stanford. I will talk to you next week.